You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education issue review for the edition covering the 26th of February to the 4th of March 2015. My name's Chris Parr. I'm joined by reporter Holly Else and deputy features editor Paul Jump. Will tweaking the formula that allocates quality-related funding based on the results of the Research Excellence Framework put pressure on universities to be more selective about which staff are submitted for future assessments? We'll find out shortly. That's certainly one of the concerns highlighted in a piece by Holly. We'll also have the story of a senior psychology professor who's denied wrongdoing after a blog highlighted what it says is a high rate of self-citation in papers published in journals that he edited. But first, our splash this week is all about access, the number of students universities take from deprived areas. Jack's not with us just now, but I spoke to him earlier about his piece. So, Jack, your story this week is about the Office for Fair Access. I imagine you've been speaking to Professor Les Ebden, who heads up that organisation. What's the angle? What's changing? What's new?
Well, this is the launch of Offa's new five-year strategy. And for the first time, they're going to be setting themselves some targets to on participation. And they want 5% of students from the poorest 20% of areas in the UK to attend highly selective universities. Now, that might seem like quite a modest target, but what's interesting is that Offa has never really set itself targets on entry rates. Mm. They've always focused on making sure that the pool of applicants grew and that students were supported and that universities spent enough money on helping poor students. And so there's a subtle shift, and it's a move from inputs in terms of what universities can do to help poor students to outputs. So why this is interesting is that Offa are setting themselves targets, but they can't, and they're not allowed to set universities' targets. That would be a breach of the law as it now stands.
So the book stops with them, basically. If this target isn't hit, it's a failing of Offa, and not necessarily a failing for the individual institutions, because that doesn't sound like a way to get universities to widen their intake.
Yeah, it's interesting. They're setting themselves a target, but they can't set universities' targets. So some people are maybe worried that this target Offa setting itself might become a target for them. But then also this autumn the student number controls are going to be lifted, so many more students might be entering universities. So in a way Offa might be pushing at an open door here. Lots of students from poor backgrounds are going to go to university anyway, so this is just a way of sort of putting it within a framework that they can judge how successful they've been. So lots of things going on in the sector around access. But this could be controversial because Offa has said it's going to be setting more challenging targets, and this would then go back to it could potentially lead to a situation where we had 2 years ago when lots of newspapers were saying that Les Ebden was trying to socially engineer universities and create a sort of, trying to stop middle class students going there and have lots of poorer students in there. So whether this might be seen to be Les Ebden meddling, he would of course deny that.
Quite. But that's the old journalistic question, I guess. If you've got a target, you must have some kind of punishment if you don't hit that target. So is Offa going to punish itself if this figure, this 5%, fails to materialise?
Well, it's a bit hazy on what they'll do if they fail to reach these targets. I mean, it's a way of sort of judging if they've been successful or not. It doesn't really say, well, you know, what they're going to do if they don't meet it. So I think that's one that will need a little bit more explaining, and that the strategic plan doesn't really say much about that.
You can read that piece in detail on page 6 and 7 of this week's magazine. And hot on its tail on page 8 is Holly's piece about reform of research funding. We've had Ref, we've had features galore on Ref. Now we're starting to find out a bit more about how the results may sort of result in the tweaking of the formula that allocates quality-related funding. Is that right?
Yes, so Hefke made an initial announcement about the formula they will use to distribute QR funding after the REF on Friday. They've tweaked it, and they say this is to account for the increase in research ranked as four-star or world-leading in the REF, which is up 70% on the previous exercise.
Mm-hmm.
And the main change is that the weighting given to three-star or internationally excellent research has been reduced in the formula. And we've spoken some tips to some people about what this might mean. And some say it could make universities more selective about who they enter in any future assessments because the three-star work now is not worth as much as the four-star.
Which obviously has implications for researchers' prestige, I suppose, and it probably raises a few concerned eyebrows among staff who know that being, you know, part of that process is key to their work.
Yeah, and we heard a lot over the build up to the REF about staff selection and what that does to academic departments in terms of being divisive and causing controversy, really, as universities have been accused of playing the game to increase their scores.
Mm.
So that's one aspect of the change. Another could be that it could increase the concentration of research funding into the top universities, which obviously most research intensive universities, which obviously are likely to have higher volumes of the four star work. But others we've spoken to say that this won't be the case because the increase in four star research has been quite widely across the sector.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The other main change is that Hefke have removed an adjustment they made after the REE to divert some funding from the arts, humanities and social sciences into the hard sciences. But the general gist on this is people think that's a good thing because the arts, humanities and social sciences may stand to do better.
Paul, you've written extensively about the REF for us. What's your take on these sort of initial tweaks, the first reforms that really have come out of 2014's REF?
Well, I think the inevitable, really. I mean, when you look at how much four-star has gone up, you know, obviously some people were suggesting that only four-star should be funded. You know, obviously this is to some extent a halfway house. Basically what they've done is, under the old formula, four-star research used to count for sort of three times what three-star research does. It now counts for four times. So, you know, they've sort of steered a middle course, really. And I think, you know, the concerns about selectivity next time, they're no doubt increased a bit. You know, would have been increased a lot more if you'd only funded four-star research.
Mm.
I mean, I think universities submitting were well aware that you know, the funding formula was only going to be tightened. I mean, it clearly wasn't going to be relaxed. We've been heading in this direction for a while, you know, ever since two-star funding was axed a while ago. And, you know, to some extent you could say university victims of their own success here, in that, you know, the proportion of four-star has gone up so much.
That's interesting stuff. Well, you can read that story on page 8. I might throw a curveball question at you, Paul. I didn't say I was going to ask about this piece, but it's sitting there. Look at me. Holly mentioned sort of some concerns, perhaps, that sort of bigger institutions could get more funding. And that's a concern that's been raised about Sir Paul Nurse's review of the research councils, which is coming up. You've got a piece in this week looking at his objectivity, if you like. He has some positions that could maybe, you know, question his independence as the leader of that review. What have you written about this week?
Well, it's a simple, very simple story, really. They basically announced the members of his advisory board. Obviously, when this review was initially announced, only Paul Nurse's name was mentioned, and people put him together with Mark Walpert, with whom he's obviously worked closely on the Crick Institute, and sniffed a conspiracy.
Mm.
You know, recently we had an interview with Mark Walpert, you know, denying all of that and pointing out that Sir Paul would have this quite heavyweight advisory board. The names have now been mentioned, and, you know, I think it's fair to say that it's pretty heavyweight board. David Eastwood, Birmingham VC, is on it. Dame Janet Finch, former Keele VC, is there, who's obviously sort of most recently done the big report on open access. So, that, you know, these seem unlikely to be people that would be pushed around. I mean, also conspiracists in the research councils will be relieved to see that one of their chairs is on the council as well. The EPSRC chair is there. So, you know, I think this sort of does, to some extent, pour further cold water on the conspiracy theories about what this review was set up for.
Indeed, it's a review we'll watch and cover with interest in the coming weeks and months. Finally, before we go, we have a story issue again, Paul, I'm afraid. Heavy week for you this week. we have a story of a senior psychology professor who's, as I said at the start of the show, denied wrongdoing after a blog highlighted what it says is a high rate of self-citation in papers published, not in any journals, but in journals he edited himself. What's, you know, it sounds a bit suspicious. We should emphasise that he's denied that he's done anything wrong. But what's the story?
Yes, Johnny Matson, his name is, from Louisiana State University. He's published over 800 papers in his career, but he says that's not unusual in his field. Yes, he came to the attention of Dorothy Bishop, a psychology professor at Oxford, when she became aware of the fact that she was on one of his editorial boards and had no recollection of having agreed to be there. On the other hand, she does admit that her recollection of the past isn't great, and he does insist that she did indeed agree to be on the board. So anyway, be that as it may, she then sort of started to look at these journals a bit more closely and discovered that he has, in general, has a very high self-citation rate, and particularly in these journals themselves. She also looked at the speed with which they were accepted by the papers for publication, and those seemed to be pretty fast. So, you know, obviously this raises questions about the editorial practices of these journals and how much scrutiny his own papers were getting. Yeah, I mean, he's pretty robust in his own defence. He says there's no wrongdoing. His papers were edited by associate editors on the journal, i.e. not himself. You know, he says he cites everybody liberally, not just himself. He thinks, you know, so he sort of distributes credit very widely.
Indeed, thanks for that, Paul. Interesting stuff as ever. I will, as usual, highlight our cover feature this week, which is written by me and Chris Havergal. It looks at fires, earthquakes and killing sprees in universities, and more specifically, how crisis management at institutions is implemented, how universities react to those kind of unwanted incidents. That's on page, let me get it right, page 34 this week. That's all for this week's THE issue review. You can comment on anything we've discussed, or indeed anything that's in the magazine, or on our website at timeshighereducation.co.uk. You'll find us on Twitter, on Facebook, and on LinkedIn too. You'll even find us on Google+, if that's where you'd like to hang out. But until next week, that's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.